I want to talk about religious vows. And I'd like to begin in a strange place, Acts 5. We're going to cover that real quickly. We're going to go several places in the Bible. I'll try not to fire hose you too much, but when you think about the idea of vows, it's actually a pretty important topic, and it's one that we don't always think about as often as perhaps we should. So let's begin at Acts chapter 5. This is the story of Annas and Sapphira, a couple that were members of the early church there in Jerusalem. It says, but a certain man named Ananias, and with Sapphira his wife, sold a possession. Let's say it was a piece of land. Just say, okay. And he kept back part of the price, his wife also being privy or knowledgeable about it, and brought a certain part and laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled thine heart to lie to the Holy Ghost and to keep back part of the price of the land? Whilst it remained, was it not thine own? And after it was sold, was it not in thine own power? Why hast thou conceived this thing in thine heart? Thou hast not lied unto men, but unto God. And Ananias, hearing these words, fell down and gave up the ghost. That means he died. And great fear came on all of them that heard these things. And the young men arose, wound him up, and carried him out and buried him. And it was about the space of 3 hours after, when his wife, not knowing what was done, came in. And Peter answered unto her, tell me whether ye sold the land for so much. And she said, yea, for so much. Then Peter said unto her, how is it that ye have agreed together to tempt the Spirit of the Lord? Behold, the feet of them which have buried thy husband are at the door, and shall carry thee out. Then fell she down straightway at his feet, and yielded up the ghost. And the young men came in and found her dead, and carrying her forth, buried her by her husband. And great fear came upon all the church and upon as many as heard these things. And I trust that if we're paying attention to this, we're a little fearful too as a result of this story. And we like to think about the New Testament gospel, and there's a great deal of joy and a great deal of things for us to rejoice in. But yet right in the midst of this, we have this story of a couple who had some land and they sold it. And they brought the money that they made for the sale of that land to the church. And before you go too far, I want you to understand that that was fine. That was good. You know, they had a possession. They desired to share with the church. That's what a lot of people were doing. Okay. They decided that we would sell it for so much money. Let's say, I don't know, 20 gold coins. Say 20 gold coins. But then they said, let's hold back 5 of those for ourselves and let's give the church 15. Okay. Again, that's fine. That would have been fine, right? You understand that. This is not a televangelist call for all your money. Okay. I'm not doing that. But it is a very serious thing because they lied about this money. And it was such a serious matter that to make an example of them and an example for us too to consider when we think about this, these people lost their lives. And Peter, notice what Peter says. Peter says to Ananias, when you had the land, wasn't it yours? I mean, you could have kept it. You didn't have to bring it. And when you sold it, You could have just said, hey, here's half the money or here's 2/3 of it, but you've lied. And I think that underlying, even though the text doesn't tell us, obviously something more at stake was in there. There was a vow involved here. There was some sort of representation. There was some sort of claim made by them that this was all the money. We went out and we're going to sell this land and all the proceeds are going to go. You see that? That's the problem. They broke their vow. They made some sort of statement, and because of that, they paid a very serious penalty. Okay? Now, every one of us have broken vows, and we've not paid that penalty. Okay? Right? We understand that. So we understand there's a lot of mercy about vows. But I do want to stress that as we talk about this subject today, God does take vows seriously, even if we don't. You know, He says in the book of Romans, He says, let God be true and every man a liar. Okay. He knows we're liars. He knows that we purpose things. He knows that we do. He knows we're weak. There's a lot of mercy in the Bible. But I want to start here because I don't want you to think that because we're in the New Testament, because we're in the days of the gospel, that now God, who used to be a really serious fellow, is now just kind of going to let things slide. He doesn't. He really, really doesn't. If you go to Matthew chapter 5, which is the Sermon on the Mount, or part of it, Jesus talks about vows. And what he's talking about is really a problem that had crept up into the Jews there, where they would swear by things. If they were going to make a vow, or they make a promise, they were going to do something, make an offering or something, they had set up this system whereby, depending on what they swore on, that was the extent to which they had to be held accountable. So they had an out. Okay. And again, this is kind of how we think as well. But in Matthew 5:33, it says this. It says, "Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thine head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be, yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil." You see, they would have a situation where they wouldn't just say, "I promise to do this," or "I will do this." They would say, "Okay, by the throne of heaven, I will do this." Okay. And that's what Jesus is calling them to stop. You see, he's not saying don't do oaths. If you take a vow, don't swear. That's in the law. I mean, that's always been. If you promise something to God, you need to keep it. He's going to hold you to it. But what he's saying is don't make this graduated kind of thing where, as he says in another place, if you swear on the temple, you don't get held to it. But if you swear on the gold in the temple, you are. You see, that's how we think. And I want us to just kind of think about that, because, you know, especially as Baptists, we get a little nervous when we start to think about things that are in the Old Testament. You know, we don't want to. But let me tell you something. Vows are important. Let me ask you this question. How many of you guys are married? Yeah. Not all of you, but most of you are. Yeah. You took a vow. You took a vow before God, right? And if I married you, I didn't say, "Okay, do you swear by the throne of heaven?" No, I just said, "Do you promise to take this?" That's enough. That's what Jesus is talking about. Yeah, marriage vows. That's a vow before God. That's a religious vow, right? Okay. How many of you have been baptized? I think pretty much everybody here now, you know, has been baptized. That's a vow, right? You're making a promise to God. You're making a commitment to God. You're going to set aside whatever's gone in the past is past. You're going to walk in the newness of life. Obviously, we're not washing away our sins. Jesus is the one who does that. But we're committing to something. You see, vows are not bad. And as New Testament Christians, we can make vows. But if we do make them, we need to take them seriously. And that's what God is focusing on here in these messages. Now, one of the things about vows is, and I know we've all made them, and I know we've all made at least one vow like this: "God, if you will get me out of this problem, I promise I'll start whatever. I'll go back to church, or I will straighten up my life," or whatever. Okay, do you get that? Yeah. They sometimes call those foxhole conversions, right? You know, everybody's there's no atheist in a foxhole, right? You know, but that's part of being human. Okay, it's part of a thing. Whether we're in distress, or maybe there's another thing. Whenever it's not some pain or some stress that we're under, but maybe it's just we're just having this overflowing with joy. You know, you just, "Oh Lord," you know, we've been lifted to the mountaintop, and we just make some sort of vow, like, "Oh God, you know, I just want to praise you all the day." We just make some sort of promise to God. Guys, those aren't bad. But God has a certain way for us to look at them. And that's what I want us to spend time on. Ultimately, I want to go to Leviticus 27, because, you know, we've been working our way through that. But before we do that, let me just take you to a couple of places and give you some examples of some vows in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New. So you'll understand that this really is central to the Bible. It may not be something that we talk about. I don't remember ever preaching to you about vows. I don't know if you ever remember a sermon on vows. Maybe you have, but it's in the Bible, and it's an important part of the Bible, so we need to address it. That's why we're here. So I trust it's of the Lord. Let's go to Genesis 28. Genesis 28, I'm going to talk about a guy named Jacob. Now, you all are familiar with Jacob. The Bible, the story of redemption sort of begins in chapter 12 of Genesis with Abraham. And then Abraham has a son named Isaac, and then Isaac has a son named Jacob, and then Jacob is the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. Jacob is renamed Israel. Okay, so there's the promises. So sometimes God identifies himself in the Bible as the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. So this is who we're talking about. We're talking about Jacob. And you remember that Jacob was just like the rest of us. He didn't come out all clean, you know. I mean, he was a sinner just like the rest of us. And he and his mom stole the birthright from Isaac. You know, remember the story about that. And they sent Jacob to go stay with his uncle Laban, to go let his hot-headed brother Esau cool down for a while. So Jacob is kind of on the run here, right? That's what's going on in Genesis 28. And so Jacob comes to this place and he beds himself, and you know, he doesn't have any bedding or anything. He has to use rocks for a pillow, and he lays himself down and he's asleep, and he feels very alone, and he feels badly for how things are going. But then God gives him a vision. God gives him a dream. God shows him this staircase. It says a ladder, and that could mean a ladder, you know, like what we would use as a ladder. But I think a better way to think of it is like an escalator. You know, a stairway, and there's these angels that are moving up and down, you know, and he's seeing into heaven. And obviously, ultimately, Jesus talks about that with Nathanael. Says, you know, you're going to see this. You're going to see the angels ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. So that's a representation, ultimately, of the Lord Jesus Christ and his mediating work. I mean, God's showing some favor to Jacob, right? He's showing him something like, I'm with you. And what's cool is that God actually makes a promise to Jacob. And behold, the Lord, verse 13 of Genesis 28 and 13. And behold, the Lord stood above it, that is above this stairway, and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, thy father, and the God of Isaac, that is, you know, his immediate father. The land wherein thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So not only is he saying that the natural nation of Israel would come to occupy this land, which God had promised Abraham, but he says, more importantly, your seed, your descendant, Jesus Christ, the son of Jacob, the son of Abraham, the son of David, the son of Judah, you know, the seed, the descendant would come and not just bless the nation, but to bless the whole world. He's an important fellow, and God has a plan here, and he's using Jacob. That's cool, right? I mean, this is really, really great. And notice then he makes a promise. God makes a promise of provision. He says, look, I'm going to be with you, Jacob. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to provide for you. I have these purposes, and they're going to come to pass. So you don't need to be afraid. And behold, I am with thee and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. And Jacob awakened out of his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. He was filled with fear. And he was afraid and said, how dreadful is this place? For this is none other but the house of God. And this is the gate of heaven. He understood what he had seen, right? And Jacob rose up early in the morning, and he took the stone which he had put for his pillows, and he set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, or Beth-El, right? House of God. That's what that literally means. Beth means house. El is a reference to the Lord. But the name of that city was called Luz at the first. So he made a little memorial. You know, he made a little memorial and he anointed it. He said, the Lord has appeared here. This is a holy place. Right? And that's all good. But then he does something else. He makes a vow, right? That's what we're talking about this morning. He makes a voluntary oath, a voluntary commitment upon himself to the Lord. And it says, and Jacob vowed a vow saying, if God will be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on. so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And this stone, which I have set for a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. So he's making some promises, isn't he? He's promising that he will come back and worship God in this place. This will be a consecrated place. He'll come back and sacrifice there. And this was a place of sacrifice. In fact, this is ultimately where Jeroboam put a golden calf. I mean, this has a lot of history here in this place in Bethel. And he says, of all the riches that you give me, I'm going to give you a tenth. I'm going to make an offering like that and so on. And he says, if you'll do this, then you'll be my God. Okay. So a lot of people have thought about this oath, right? God makes a promise to Jacob, and it was not a conditional promise. He didn't say, all right, Jacob, now if you'll do what I tell you to do, I will bless you. No, he says, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to bless you, right? And your seed is going to explode and fill this whole land. And ultimately, your seed's going to be the one, the Messiah, the one that your father and grandfather understood would come. He's going to come from you. So there's no obligation here for Jacob to make this vow, right? I mean, you agree with that. So why did he do it? Well, I mean, I don't know. But I can tell you, I can understand how he felt. He felt afraid. He wanted to be encouraged. Maybe making this vow helped strengthen him a little bit. Maybe he felt like he wasn't sure. Maybe his faith was weak and he was thinking, well, all right, Lord, you promised to do this. If you really will do it, I'll do this. You know, there's a lot of reasons why. I mean, it's easy to criticize Jacob for making this vow. And people have. People have said, what, you know, I mean, come on, especially an old Baptist. I mean, come on, it's all grace, right? What are we bargaining with God? But we do it all the time. We bargain with God all the time. God, you know, we don't mean to. Maybe we don't do it quite as openly, right? But we've done that. And you know what? God honored this vow. Okay? God wasn't upset with him. God honored him. If you flip forward a couple of chapters, you go to Genesis 31. It's now been 20 years. Jacob made it to the land of Laban. He meets his uncle. He goes to work for him. He falls in love with his daughter, Rachel. He says, I agree. I'll work for you for 7 years if you'll give me Rachel, your daughter. Laban pulls the switcheroony and he gets Leah instead, his older sister, and he agrees to work for 7 more years to get her also. So he works for 14 years. And then for 6 more years after that, he works for his father to make, and he's only getting the animals that he separates and so on. And despite all the efforts on the part of Laban to try to cheat his son-in-law out of riches, just like he had cheated his brother, right? God blessed him. And he had all this wealth. God blessed him. So now God comes to him in a vision, and Jacob in chapter 31 of Genesis, it's been 20 years, he says, it's time for us to return. Because God appeared to me, and he said, it's time for us to go, so we need to go. And the sisters were, you know, his wives were willing to go. He says, what inheritance do we have? You know, let's go. But I wanted you to see this verse in chapter 31. The angel of the Lord, this is what, in verse 11, Jacob says this, and the angel of God spake unto me in a dream, saying, Jacob, and I said, here am I. He's telling his wives this. And he said, lift up now thine eyes and see all the rams which leap upon the cattle and reek-staked and speckled and gristled, for I have seen all that Laban doeth unto thee. He's pointing out how much God has blessed him, because that was going to be his hire. And he says, look how much I've given you. I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointest the pillar, and where thou vowest a vow unto me. Now arise, get thee out from thy land, and return unto the land of thy kindred. So God remembered his vow, right? God didn't ask for that vow, and he didn't chastise him, but he said, that's where you made that vow, and now I'm going to see that you fulfill it. Okay? Do you see that? This is how God deals with vows. When we promise something to God voluntarily, it's a voluntarily offering. There were offerings like that under the Old Testament, even before the law, right? The desire to give something to the Lord or to commit to something, and God honors that. But he also holds us to it, like we learned in the story of Ananias and Sapphira. Okay, let's talk about another vow. If that one, I would say, was a pretty good vow. Obviously, God honored it. Let's talk about a bad vow, a vow that should not have been made. And let's go to Judges chapter 11. Okay, Judges chapter 11. This is in the days of a man named Jephthah. He's one of the judges. There were 12 judges in the period of time after the nation of Israel did, in fact, get rescued from Egypt in the days of Moses. And they walked through on the Red Sea, and you remember that they went to Mount Sinai, received the law, and they refused to go into the land. So that generation perished in the wilderness. But finally, under the leadership of Joshua, they were brought into the land of Canaan, the land of promise, the promised land, the land that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were now taking possession of it. And for the next 350 years or so, they were ruled by judges. God would raise up men from time to time. And you know some of these judges, you know, Samuel was one, obviously. Samson was one. You know, Gideon was probably the most famous one. Well, Jephthah was another one. And Jephthah was there towards the end. And you got to understand that by this time, the people of Israel, even though they had had the law for hundreds of years now, they were pretty dark in their understanding. They had become very superstitious. They had adopted a lot of the religious darkness around them. And so Jephthah is a man who was raised up by God to be a judge and to deliver the people from the Ammonites who were oppressing the people. So it says in verse 29 of Judges 11 and 29, "Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed over Gilead and Manasseh, and passed over Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed over unto the children of Ammon. And Jephthah vowed a vow unto the Lord, and said, If thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into mine hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering." Okay, so kind of rash. You know, obviously, the Spirit of the Lord's come upon Jephthah. And once again, he's been told by the Lord, lead the people out to battle against this mighty army. And God says, I'm going to give you the victory, but he still makes a vow. Okay? And maybe again, maybe the vow was to just ensure victory. Maybe it was to quell his own faith. Maybe it was like, Lord, you're going to do this. I'm willing to pay. You know, I mean, part of this is not bad because like when David was up on the mount of Moriah, and the angel was, causing great, pestilence on the land, and he was going to sacrifice. And the man there offered him just, hey, take this stuff, make a sacrifice. And David said, no, I'll buy it from you, because I will not sacrifice unto the Lord that which I have not paid for. All right. There's this desire to pay. But here this guy makes a pretty rash vow. I mean, it's a little misplaced zeal on the part of Jephthah, because he says, whatever comes out, the first thing I see, whether it be man or beast, I'm going to offer it as a burnt offering. Again, obviously, God does not delight in burnt offering. That's not a good vow. It's a stupid vow, yeah. It's a pagan vow, because the people around them were the ones that would do human sacrifice. And those are the people who run our world today, by the way, just so you'll know. But it's true. I mean, Canaanite religion. So what happens? Went to battle, got the victory. Jephthah's coming home victorious and excited. And guess who comes out to meet him first? Who? His daughter. That's right, his daughter. She's out. She's all excited. She's dancing and, you know. And Jephthah falls down and his heart is broken. He rips his clothing and he says, oh, my daughter, my lass, you've made this awful. Let's read what it says. It came to pass when he saw her, this is verse 35, that he rent his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low, and thou art one of them that troubleth me. For I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back. This was his only daughter. And she was beautiful, and you know, all of his hopes of having, you know, children and grandchildren, his line continuing, it was all in her. And he is very sad. And notice what she does is she says, oh, father, you made a vow. You can't go back on that. The Lord gave you victory. Just give me 2 months so that I can go and bewail my virginity with my friends up in the mountains, but then I will return. And so that's what happened. They went back. And then it says in verse 39 that it came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned unto her father, who did with her according to his vow, which he had vowed. And she knew no man. And it was a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite, 4 days in a year. Okay, so there's two theories on what happened here. One theory is that he did in fact put her to death. You know, just like Abraham had called to, God had called Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac, except Isaac didn't get to get up. You know, it's one theory is that she was actually, you know, he killed her and burned her body, you know, as a sacrifice to God in fulfillment of that vow. The other possibility, though, is that if you look at the wording carefully, it is possible that instead, if it had been an animal, it would have been sacrificed. But if it was a woman, it was consecrated to the Lord. So she had to basically live alone and not have any children, which that, you know, that's marginally better, but it's still a great awfulness because now no kids. I mean, this was the glory. Everybody wanted to give birth to the Messiah, right? I mean, you know, and his line was going to die. I don't know which it is. If you're objective and you just read it, I think she burned. Okay, that's kind of what I think happened, which makes this a really awful story, right? Even if she was just cloistered, right? It's still awful, but burning her is even worse. And yet, this guy felt like he was obligated to do it because he'd made a vow. So see, religious vows are pretty serious, especially if you don't have a good understanding of how God looks at them. Really bad things can happen when you take a vow. I mean, I read about in the New Testament where there were 40 men who took a vow that they would not eat or drink until they had murdered Paul, right? I mean, when Paul was in custody of the Romans, and that's why they sent him by night with like 200 troops to get him to Caesarea, because there were people who had vowed this. I mean, people, you can go a little crazy. I mean, religious vows can motivate a lot of wickedness. They're not just automatically good just because you made a religious vow. A, doesn't mean it was a good vow. And B, it doesn't mean it's pleasing God. But we have this impulse, you see. We have this impulse. Okay. All right. Now, by the way, I'll give you a little bit of a head. God provided a way for Jephthah to get out of this vow. We'll talk about that in a minute when we get to Leviticus, you see. That's the interesting thing about this. But let me give you a couple more examples, just not to belabor the point, but Jonah, when he was in the belly of the whale, we don't need to turn there, but think about it. Remember, he refused to preach the gospel to the Ninevites, the Assyrians. He hated them. He'd rather go to Spain. He'd rather leave the presence of the Lord. It's really hard to leave the presence of the Lord, though. Okay? And so he got tossed overboard, and he was swallowed by a fish, and he's in the belly of the whale at the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea. But then in the depths, he cries out. And this is what's recorded for us in the book of Jonah. He says that I will pay that which I have vowed, salvations of the Lord. And at that point, that's when he got spit out on dry land, and he made his way to Nineveh, and he preached. He was never very happy about it, but he was very effective. But notice that I will pay that which I have vowed. What do you think he vowed? We don't know what the vow is, but obviously he had made some sort of vow to the Lord, like, Lord, I'll go anywhere you want me to go. If you'll raise me up, I mean, I will do what you have told me to do, right? That's a vow. You understand that, right? We've all made that prayer. Lord, let your will be done. That's a vow, right? And here God held him to it. And so he remembered that he would keep that vow. So do you see that? This is kind of cool, right? And there's other examples. There's examples in the New Testament. We read in the book of Acts 19, even though Paul was a Christian, he still took a Nazarite vow. It tells us that he, after having spent all of this time in Corinth and the Lord had delivered him, evidently he made some sort of vow. And it was an appropriate vow. He made his way back to Jerusalem. He says, I've got to get back in time, you know, because I've got this vow that I've got to fulfill. All right? And you might say, well, what in the world, Paul, why are you following the law? Well, he was still a Jew, right? He was still a Jew. He was still his ability. He could still do it. Right? He wasn't making his own righteousness, but you see that? He had made a vow. What about Peter? I'll go with you, Lord, even unto death. Right? These other jokers over here might abandon you, but I will follow you to death. Yeah. And of course, you know what the Lord said to him? Peter, cock's going to crow twice, and you'll have already denied me thrice. And he did. But notice, God held him to that vow too. Because he did die. He did follow him. The tradition tells us that he was crucified. He took it gladly. I mean, that's not in the Bible, but I mean, you see what? God takes our vows seriously. In the Old Testament and the New. You see, vows are not just something that's in the law. The law was given to teach us about Jesus Christ, and we've been released from the requirements of that law, but some things are still the same, right? I mean, murder was the sixth commandment. But you realize that before Moses came down the mountain with the tablets, before he came down, it was still wrong to murder, right? It wasn't because God put it on the Ten Commandments that made it wrong to murder. It was always wrong to murder, right? They were just codifying. And that's what the law did, right? The law was never intended to try to make these people holy and righteous before God or earn their way to heaven or earn their way. But what God said and you just read through this, you can see it so plainly, that when God gave the law to the people, which was a good thing, he said, look, I'm a holy and righteous God. And you all are an unwashed, unrighteous people. You're sinners. But I'm going to dwell in the midst of you. I am, by my mercy, I'm pleased to dwell in the midst of you. And so for that reason, you do these things. Don't pollute the camp. You know, take your shoes off the ground. Don't do this stuff around me because you're in my presence. Notice, nothing in that says that those people, by keeping the law, supposedly, would somehow be righteous. That's what they thought. That's what it became. That's what they came to think it meant. And that's why Jesus was so hard on them. But can you see that the law was never intended to make them righteous. It made them holy in the sense that he had made them holy. But they weren't like suddenly not sinners. So God made provision throughout all the law to give us mercy. There's mercy and grace throughout the Bible because that's who God is. So let's go look at Leviticus 27, right? I know that was a terribly long introduction to get to Leviticus 27, but there's a reason for that. Because when I read this chapter, you know, we're all reading our way through the Bible. I read this chapter and I was like, what in the world is this? Have I read this before? What is going on? You know, it's good for us to read the Bible, and I want you to continue to do that, even if it doesn't make a lot of sense, or maybe it's a bunch of genealogies and you think it's dry. Trust me. God gave this to us for a reason. If he wants you to know how big the temple was or how long these curtains were or whatever, I mean, there's a reason for it. And you don't always know why, but you are transformed by the Word of God and nothing else. It's good to have extra stuff to read, you know, to help, but you got to be in the Word of God. It's the Word of God that transforms you. And this is no different. So let's go to Leviticus 27 real quick. I won't take a lot of time on this, but I want to say it to you. This is the last chapter in the book of Leviticus. And as I said to you all last time I was with you all, I think that if we all were honest and we said, which is our favorite Old Testament book, except for David. David, this probably is your favorite book. Yeah. It probably is. Leviticus probably is David's favorite Old Testament book. Mine's probably Ecclesiastes, but I'm not sure. But very few people would say Leviticus is their favorite. But there's a lot in here about Jesus Christ. So let's look at the mercy that's in this. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, this is Leviticus 27, speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them, when a man shall make a singular vow, the persons shall be for the Lord by thy estimation. And then he goes on to say it. Now, what does that mean? This is talking about a vow where somebody is dedicated to the Lord. What he's saying is that we're going to standardize. We're going to put some guardrails around this practice because somebody either from fear, your child is lying sick, so you make promises to God. Every one of us have done that. Or you're full of joy and you just want to dedicate someone like Hannah did. Hannah obviously dedicated her son. That was a vow, right? That wasn't a Leviticus 27 vow. That was a number 6 vow, a vow of the Nazarite. But can you see there was nothing wrong with Hannah saying, Lord, if you'll give me a son, I'll give him to you, right? I mean, that was a good thing. God blessed her for that. We're all blessed because of Samuel. So you see, vows are not bad. Vows are good. Jesus took a vow to come and save us. So, I mean, do you see that? In the eternal covenant, Father, I'll come and deliver your children, right, safe to you. So, I mean, vows are not a bad thing. They're good. The Spirit moves us. But here what he's saying in this is that, okay, if you're going to make a vow, here's some guardrails. Here's some limits. We're going to keep you out of your misplaced zeal a little bit. And one of the first things he says is that if you vow a vow and someone is dedicated to the service of the Lord or to be consecrated unto the Lord, whether it's yourself or a member of your household or so, he goes through and says, okay, this is the estimation, this is the valuation of their service. And what he's saying is, he's not saying that men are more important than women or young men are adults are better than old people. But in an agrarian society, from an economic standpoint, a man who is between 20 and 60 is still in the prime of his life. And I can tell you that because I'm only going to be 60 for about 3 more weeks. I can tell you why it drops off. You know, a dude that's between 20 and 60 gets valued at 50 shekels. And then a guy who's 61 is 15. And I can see why. because I can see that. I can see that my labor is not nearly as good as it used to be. I'm tapering off quick. And those of you who are in your young whippersnappers, you just enjoy it while you got it, okay? Your youthful zeal, because you're going to be it like me too. But anyway, you see, it has nothing to do with intrinsic value. We're all of infinite worth to the Lord Jesus Christ. We have zero value of ourselves, but God has placed upon us infinite worth. And it doesn't matter who we are. You know, Jew or Greek, or male or female, or young or old, or black or white, it doesn't matter. All of his people are in the palm of his hand. But what the valuing that's going on here is, in an agrarian society, an adult man can raise more food, you know, than a woman can. So that's why the valuations are different. Now you might be saying, okay, so what, how does this work? No money changes hands, right? You don't go and, I mean, what the Lord's trying to do is say, you get filled with zeal and you want to dedicate your life to the Lord. Good. He's like, fine. Okay. That value is worth 60 shekels or 50 shekels or 15 shekels or whatever it is in this law. But you don't pay the money. Nothing happens. But if you want to be released from that vow, then that's the amount that you pay plus 20% to redeem it. Okay. You see that? So that's what's going on here. Because He's got plenty of workers. You know, the temple's full of Levites already. You know, we don't want to have 100 people show up and say, hey, I've been dedicated to the Lord. What, you know, put me to work. No, go home. It's better for you to stay and honor God home. But this is a way to recognize that. Do you see that? This is what God is doing. This is a sweetness. And the same is with animals or land or other things. You can work through this. There's an opportunity to redeem them. That God is putting this in the law. And this was in the law on the day of Jephthah. Think about that. This existed. When Jephthah made that vow, he could have gone to the priest and said, look, I made this rash vow. I dedicated my daughter. And the priest would open up the scroll and say, okay, well, that's 12 shekels plus, you know, yeah, 15 shekels. And he could have been released. That just, isn't that interesting? So Jephthah, this rash vow, that just adds to the horror of that story. Because God foresaw that these kinds of things would happen. Do you see that? That's why Leviticus 27 is here. But the principles of Leviticus 27 also extend into the New Testament. Remember, I read to you what our Savior said about this. Don't swear by your head, or don't swear by this, because why did they do that? Oh, let's go to Matthew 23. I'll give you a little bit more. We got a little bit more time. Let me give you some more background, because see, Leviticus 27 was all that the Jews needed with regard to getting in or out of vows. If you made a rash vow, you pay a 20% penalty and you're done. You know, you're out. That God said, this is how it is. But they didn't stick with that. They didn't like that. They set up this hierarchy where if you made some vows, you had to keep them. But if you had made other vows, you didn't have to keep them. Remember in Mark chapter 7, Jesus is pointing out to that. You have made it a tradition which violates the law of God, where you can make a vow that all of your wealth belongs to God, and therefore you don't have to pay to take care of your mom and dad in their old age. You say it's korban, that is gift. You've made an offering. And that was just this workaround that they had did to play games. And you see, God does not like that. Okay? The commandment says take care of your father and your mother. And you don't get out of that commandment by dedicating all your wealth to the Lord. In fact, you're not supposed to give all the wealth to the Lord. And in fact, if you did something stupid like that, you can get it back. You know, God expects us. You see this framework? That's what's underneath all of this. This vow information in the Bible. Let's go to Matthew 23. Here Jesus is tearing into the Pharisees. And at verse 16 it says this, Matthew 23:16. Woe unto you, ye blind guides, which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing, but whosoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he is a debtor. Okay, so you're sitting here making a business deal or making some sort of commitment, whatever, and if you don't swear, if you swear by the, I swear by the temple that I'll deliver those donkeys by Thursday, and then you don't deliver by Thursday, and then you say, oh yeah, but I swore by the temple. You should have made me swear by the gold in the temple, so I'm not held. You see how rotten that is? Yeah, it's awful. And God hates that. And God hates that in our lives. Let your saying be yea, yea. Just say what you're going to do. If you're going to make a vow, keep it. Right? God is honored by that. If God moves upon your heart to do something, I mean, I'm saying that vows are wrong, but keep them. And don't get into this hierarchy where we're trying to, you know, fool God, trying to trick God, get out of it. Ye fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifieth the gold? And whosoever shall swear by the altar is nothing, but whosoever sweareth by the gift that's appointed, he is guilty, saying? You know, they're denigrating the things that are representative of God and ultimately Jesus Christ, and they're just being flippant with it. And we live in a very flippant society, right? I mean, we live in a very irreligious society. Well, Jesus is saying we need to live differently as disciples of Jesus Christ. We just need to keep our promises. And God understands there's times whenever we might have a desire. I might have a desire to give a bunch of money to the church so we can build a thing, but then my circumstances are such that I can't keep it. I mean, obviously I'm going to be ashamed by that, but it's not like I'm going to be struck dead, right? But it would have been better if I hadn't made that vow. But there's mercy. You see that? There's mercy. You know, you make a vow that you're going to remain faithful to your wife, but you might break it. I mean, there's still a path to reconciliation. You shouldn't do that. You're not going to fall down dead. We're not under the law. We're under grace. But let's keep our vows. Let's not get in a situation where we're breaking them. Let's do that which is right. We've all committed to follow Jesus Christ by being baptized. Let's not break it. Let's not just allow ourselves to drift away and not have it matter that much to us. We're not looking at it right. And this is what Jesus is saying. He says, don't be flippant. Ye fools and blind, whether is greater the gift or the altar that sanctifieth the gift? Whosoever therefore shall swear by the altar sweareth by it and by all things thereon. And whosoever shall swear by the temple sweareth by it and by him that dwelleth thereon. And he that shall swear by heaven sweareth by the throne of God and by him that sitteth thereon. You see, God has given us a great privilege that he's showing us great honor. We don't have to bolster. If we say we'll do something, he'll accept it. We don't have to say, okay, I swear by your throne, great God, that, you know, I'll do this or that. No. He just says, just tell me if it's on your heart to do something, tell me. And I'll honor that. I'll honor that. Right? I mean, in this, you see that? That's what he's talking about. And the early church, and what's funny about this, a lot of funny things, I guess, because we're funny. The early church had this problem. James, in the book of James, you know, this is the letter that James wrote to the Christians there who were mostly Jews. In verse 12 of James 5, he says this, but above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yea be yea and your nay, nay, lest you fall into condemnation. So you can kind of see how that even the early church, they got back into the old habits of swearing. And this, that doesn't mean vows, they're making vows, but they're affirming the vows by different things. Just say what you're going to do. Be people of your word. If God moves you to make a vow, make a commitment to Him, then that's a good thing. Keep it. That's the New Testament pattern. And in closing, I want to go one more place, and that is in Romans chapter 12. It doesn't specifically talk about vows, but I think it does. Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, I beg you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. You know, a lot of times we find in the Bible where people were making vows and things because they were seeking a closer deliverance or something from God. Hannah wanted a child. Jacob wanted assurance that he was going to go out to battle, as did Jephthah, as did others. Paul desired to express gratitude to God for him. All of this is good. But notice what Paul here is saying is that really, you ought to live your life, if you're a Christian, you ought to live your life like you have dedicated your life, your whole being to God. In other words, you ought to look at your life as if you've made a Leviticus 27 vow of everything that you have and everything that you are and all of your household and all of your family and all of your goods, because they are His. You see that? I mean, you might say in one sense there's no room for a Christian to make a vow because everything already belongs to God. Yeah, and that's the, I think that's ultimately where, why vows are important, because God voluntarily desires us to love Him and to choose to want to come to church and to serve Him and to read His Word and to follow His commandments and to do the things. And He says, as you do these things, that's how you'll discern the will of God. That's probably one of the reasons why people did vows to begin with. You know, I'm not sure if this is going to happen or not or whatever. But if we wholly consecrate ourselves to God as a living sacrifice, all of us, every day we live, we're not living for ourselves, we're living for Him. The money we have, it's His. Our car, it's His. You know, our time, our lead, it's His. And we'll do whatever He wants us to do. And that's a vow that I think He wants us to make. And I think that's the only way that as a child of grace, you're going to find any comfort in any kind of, you know, sanity of mind. Because I think that's where He wants us to be. So I think that's really ultimately what vows are all about. This voluntary offering to God. And so I'm going to close this there. But I think if you're very kind of attention, and I hope that you'll think about this. And the next time you're tempted to make a vow to God, it's okay. But ask Him about that and make sure you keep it. All right. God bless you.